Hi, it's Eben Pagan. Today I'm really excited to be talking to a woman that I've been making friends with over the last couple of years named Susan Bratton. And Susan is the CEO of a company called Personal Life Media. But what makes Susan really interesting to me is that she has worked in the entire gamut of business. Susan went to business school and got her degree, like a good starting business person should, but unlike most of the people who get degrees and then don't go on to do anything with them, she went on to start several companies. She sits on the boards of several companies. And in the conversation that we were having before this interview, she mentioned that one of her best learning experiences was starting a company at zero, growing all the way to 3,000 employees, and then taking it all the way back down to zero. And then just kind of as a little side note here, Susan is just plain frickin' cool because we hung out at Burning Man and met a lot of really interesting people. And she's just one of the most fascinating people that I've met. So welcome, Susan.
Eben, I am luxuriating in how the tables are turned and you're interviewing me. This is nice. I don't have to look at notes. I just have to be present to your questions.
Yeah, so thank you. I've got lots of them.
I'm ready.
You seem to embody a lot of different things that I've noticed about successful entrepreneurs. You kind of know everyone. You've done a little bit of work at all levels of business. You seem to constantly be improving yourself and kind of learning from new people. And one of the questions that I have, which is actually where I never start, is do you have some kind of an underlying principle or an approach to business? Like, what's the overarching theme to how you've built this?
Well, the overarching theme for me is that I've always thought about myself as a salesperson. And that has served me well, no matter what my role has been. And I always think about it from the perspective of how can I delight whatever customer I'm targeting at the time. And so everything that I do and all of my focus is always to just kind of learn more about what that customer wants and what I need to do to give it to them.
So how do you learn? What's your favorite technique for learning what they want?
Well, that just depends on what technology is available, because I'm a geek. I'm a girl geek, and I just like technology a lot. So I learn about my customers in a lot of different ways. I talk to them. I send them emails. I do market research with very simple tools like SurveyMonkey. When I have an opportunity, when there's a customer who has frustrations, I really like to get into that because I'm driven by customer insights. I really like that part of marketing and product positioning and coming up with companies more than anything else. I've also used a lot of everything from Nielsen data, so going out and buying data and getting information about market segments and doing overlays and crosstabs on data. I've done that. I also talk to other people in my industry. You know, Eben, the thing that you say about creating mastermind groups, getting together birds of a feather and talking about your customers and the target market and what they want and how you're slicing and dicing it, all of that's really good. So I'm a big believer in co-opetition, a huge believer in co-opetition. You said earlier that, you know, I'm one of those people who's connected. And a part of that is that I'm almost always connected to my competitors as well as, you know, my customers and all of the other people in the industry. So a lot of different tools and techniques that I use to get to who they are and what they want.
In most of the interviews that I do, Susan, the people that I interview typically specialize in kind of one thing. They've either grown a company or they advise a lot of companies, etc. You're a rare person that has started several businesses, grown several businesses, run several businesses, who's sat on the board of several businesses, advised them, etc. And I'm thinking that might be a nice way to slice and dice and chunk this. So let's start out with starting a business.
Sure.
You mentioned in one of our conversations that you've got some interesting stories about starting businesses and what you've learned doing that. What have been some of your best lessons for successfully starting a business that's going to work?
Geez, it's funny. The first one I thought of was the lesson that I learned that I should have known the business wasn't going to work.
That's a good one.
I don't think you can ever tell if a business is going to work or not. And I don't think that it matters what the market strategy is, what the product is, how great it is. I think so much of it comes from the culture, and the culture comes from the top down, that I think sometimes the biggest part of it is the leader and the team that leader brings around them and how they move through the problems and opportunities. So I'd say that's probably the number one thing that I've learned is watch your leader. Get a real understanding of his or her strengths and weaknesses. And if you think they're a winner, fill in their weaknesses or help find a way to fill in their weaknesses.
And if you're a leader, you mentioned the word culture. Define culture from your perspective.
Sure. I'll give you an example. I can tie both those things together in this example. When I was running Excite at Home's sales and marketing business, I had about a couple hundred people who reported to me. And I was running sales, marketing, operations, market research, market development for what essentially was five companies that had been acquired and rolled up together. There was just a ton of siloing, infighting, struggling for resources, etc. And I decided that our job as an organization, what was really important to the bulk of the people who are at all of these different companies, was innovation. Innovation in media, innovation in advertising. And so I came up with a common theme that I felt could meet all of the people from all of these organizations. And I pulled them together and told them that this was our goal and this was our strategy. This was not only our internal strategy that would satisfy us, which was being a technology market leader in the advertising space, but that it was also the kind of client that we were going to go out and find. And so people rallied around this idea of us not just being a media company or being another search engine like Excite was or another broadband company or whatever it might be, but we were going to be an innovator in advertising. The organization really took to that, and we were able to attract customers who began to see that that was our approach, and they wanted to be with us because of that. At the same time, I knew that what I was really good at was setting vision and strategy, seeing what talent was in my group and tasking them with the things they were really good at. But then the other thing that I understood about myself was that I was terrible at tracking the numbers. I was terrible at doing the business updates for my boss and my boss's boss. And I hated doing those things. And so I had two assistants at the time. And one of my assistants was the warm, fuzzy person who took care of all of the employee problems and my schedules and my calendars and was a more administrative assistant. The other person was a chief of staff kind of a person, the person who ran all the numbers, dealt with the budgets, told people, you know, rolled up all the reports so that when I walked into meetings with my peers and my boss, I looked totally buttoned up because I knew I couldn't do it all. So I made sure that the number one resource that I had in my organization was what I needed to make everyone successful because I couldn't get the resources I needed unless I looked buttoned up. And so that was a smart thing that I did was understanding that I hated spreadsheets and PowerPoint. I mean, I can do them, but really, if I can get anyone else to do them for me, I will. And that was successful for me.
So you mentioned a few issues that most people that are starting and growing businesses, they're not even thinking about.
Yeah.
You said siloing, infighting, and struggling for resources.
Yeah.
And I don't think we realize when we're starting a business that we're going to have humans working there later and that these people have their own needs and they've got, you know, kind of the inner chimpanzee, you know, working for them, and they get into these, you know, various types of power struggles with each other. Will you talk a little bit about, you know, what is the phenomenon called siloing? How does infighting happen? You know, what happens when people struggle for resources inside of a business? Like, what's really going on there, and how do you set it up so that that actually doesn't happen in the beginning?
Yeah. So I think the way you set it up so that it doesn't happen in the beginning is that the leader has a clear prioritization of goals that are a list that's doable instead of impossible. That's one thing. If if the leader is trying to get everybody to do everything and accomplish too much, then the resources get even more scarce. They're always scarce, you know. Scarce and resource should mean scarce in the business world, because there's always, you always want to do more than you can do. But if the leader doesn't say our clear priorities are these and tells everyone that they're important and that their thing is equal to everything else, then everybody's fighting for all the resources in the organization. They're fighting for budget. They're fighting for headcount. They're fighting for the best offices. They're fighting over everything. The other thing is that there are leaders who play people off against each other, and there are leaders who bring people together as a team against a common goal. And I think that more often I've found the former rather than the latter. And if you are that kind of manager and you think you might be, it's good to reassess the possibility that you might need to do a better job letting everyone understand how they have to work together for the common good of the organization. So a silo is just somebody who has their group, their team, their budget, and their deliverables. And if there are all these different groups and they all have their deliverables, they're not focused on the bigger picture. And that's where a corporate leader has to set the vision and the culture, how you're going to accomplish that. We've all heard the stories about how at Microsoft, either you get the crap kicked out of you or you kick the crap out of somebody else. And it's all about, you know, standing up in meetings and being the smartest one, or organizations where the last person talking gets his way, you know, and they wrestle everything to the ground until the fighter who's willing to fight the hardest wins. You know, these are not good management styles, but they're management styles that happen every day in every organization. Not every. Good organizations don't have a lot of this, right? And so I think the onus is on the leader to set clear goals. That being said, it's really good if the leader has a team of people who can call them on those, any lack of clarity around that. If there's a way that the team can say, we're not sure if I should do this project or that guy should do his project first or get the money for it, which one's going to get us to our goal faster? So I think those are the silos, the culture, the resources issues that you run into.
Mm. What are some other things that someone that's starting a business can do to, you know, almost beam their values system and their idea of what the culture should be into those critical first people on the team to make sure that it gets into the DNA?
Two ways to do it, and you have to do both. You have to communicate what you'd like the values of the organization to be by saying things like, look, we're going to be an organization that focuses on innovation, or we're going to be an organization that has a really liberal policy about bringing dogs to work, you know, whatever it is, whatever's the culture you want to create. And then you have to embody that as well. So you have to just be liberal about bringing dogs into the organization, or bring your dog into the organization. I'm using a silly example, but sure, it's a combination of those things. So a lot of times I think getting your team to taking the time to get your team together to say, here's what we are and here's what we're not, is a really good way to structure the initial organization. And then HR, who's ever doing your hiring, if they clearly understand what kind of culture you're trying to create, for Google as an example, trying to create the Brainiac culture, you know, the way their hiring process is so sturdy and so defined about the, you know, what they want their people to fit into, what their box is that's acceptable to them. So when you're hiring, making sure that your recruiters and the people who resource your talent really get the kind of people you're looking for.
Excellent. So as a business is growing and, you know, you've kind of seeded it and you've figured out, all right, this idea works, customers buy this thing, and now you've got to go to work, as Michael Gerber would say, on your business, hiring people, building systems, sometimes setting policies and so forth. You know, what have you learned about this transition that's important for an entrepreneur to know?
there's a real shift when you hit the, you know, when you start out and you start, you have a startup, you have your founding team of people. And, you know, the Silicon Valley, my founding team of people that I was on was always, there's the person who runs development and engineering. There's the person who runs sales and marketing. There's the person who runs product management, you know, and then there's the kind of the soft side of the finance and, you know, the G&A. And you've got your early group in there, and maybe you've created a product because you've had this vision, this insight, and you're getting some traction about it. And then you do need to bring in the infrastructure people. Well, a lot of times you've brought some systems from past organizations. And what I've also found a lot of times, at least here in the Silicon Valley, is that teams of people start companies over and over. We're serial entrepreneurs, and we get the same people into the next company and the next company because there's a shorthand that comes from that and a trust that comes from understanding who that person is and what they can deliver. And you bring in those systems people, and all of a sudden you have the innovators, the creators, the visionaries who know that they need to have the systems people and the policy people, and there's a clash because all of a sudden those policy people are shutting down those creative people, and there's this like massive amount of friction that happens where the creative people and the visionaries are like railing against all this foundation stuff. And I've seen time and time again where the entrepreneur, the original inventor, the guy or the woman who created the business is kicked to the curb or moved into the chairman's role or, you know, something, moved to a side, some other, there's, you know, 50 nice little terms for it that happen if they get to keep their job and stay in the organization. But usually the board or the management team or the investors or that combination of people bring in an ops person, a good block and tackle person that's a good communicator, that can get out there and sell the business, who can get the teams working, who's good at managing the money, which is usually not the entrepreneur.
You know, as I've been experimenting with different ideas for growing a business and just kind of looking at the things that work and the things that don't, I see that there are a few like little mistakes that lots of entrepreneurs make, right? Little things where they don't really, you know, see the challenge coming. One of them is being an entrepreneur. Oftentimes we like to create new stuff and we like to, you know, keep changing the system. Whereas when it comes to growing a business, sometimes you got to choose an idea and then just kind of roll with it, right? And get everyone on the same page. Do you have any advice on how we can, you know, change our mindsets a little bit and get into growing the business mode rather than doing new stuff all the time?
Well, there's a couple things. I think the internet has given us almost a get out of jail free card around putting out a product that's not quite perfect and then continually making it better. There's a new mindset, the, you know, fail early, fail fast, fail often construct. And I think that there are a lot of entrepreneurs now who are, for the first time in the era of the startup world, they can do that. They can have failures. I mean, even 10 years ago, it was not considered good if you had a startup that failed. And now it's fine to have some failures under your belt because at least you've gotten partway there. You're more likely to get funded if you've started up any company before versus someone who's never started a company before. That's a higher risk. So even the failures get funded faster sometimes than the brand new entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a culture shift in the entrepreneurial space, which I think is really beneficial. Once again, the single thing that an entrepreneur needs to do is get a trusted team of people who are allowed to tell him or her when they disagree with the direction. So if there's anything that you could learn as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, as a person growing your own organization, it's what's that thing that you need to do to allow people to communicate with you in a way that's safe for them, that you can hear, because they're going to tell you when you're over innovating, when you're bringing out too many products, when you need to go back and just get sell through on existing inventory, whatever it might be. Your team knows, and I'll tell you, those middle managers, it's not even your direct reports necessarily. It's the middle managers who are playing in the trenches of the business who can give you, I think, some of the most invaluable feedback. So it's the communication, the culture of communication that you can set.
Yeah, one of the things that I do sometimes, Susan, is, you know, I tell the super organized project managers, I say things like, you know, I have too many ideas and I'm going to want to come up with a bunch of new stuff. So make sure and keep us on track so I don't interrupt our business. And it's great because they do.
Yeah.
You know, they come up and they say, hey, you know, I'm getting a little nervous here. You know, we said we wanted to get this done by this date. And if we do this new thing that you're talking about, it's going to push that back. And then I go, oh, okay. All right. Well, let's wait on my new idea.
And, you want to hear a funny story?
Yeah. Yeah. Hit me.
So I like this because I'm not recommending it. I think it's kooky, but I also think it's directional. There's a company that I'm associated with that I know that I've called on as a possible partner in Boulder, Colorado. And they have taken this strategy that comes, I think, I don't know where it comes from, maybe Landmark or something, but it comes from kind of the personal growth workshop world. And it's called a withhold. Have you ever heard of a withhold?
I have.
Okay. So you know that it's a way that you can tell someone something and you get to say to them something that you might not have. You've been withholding it. Something happened and you want to go tell them that thing. And the rule of the game of a withhold is that, Eben, if you said something that for some reason my heart got hurt, not that you ever have, but if that ever happened, I could come to you and say, Eben, I have a withhold. Could I tell this to you? And there's this certain language that you're supposed to follow, which I don't even remember. And you say, yeah, definitely. And so then I say, when you said that, I felt blank, you know, whatever it was. And then you're just supposed to say, thank you. And then you don't answer. Then we're done. And you get to go process that. And I feel better because I got it off my chest. And later you might want to talk to me about it. Hey, I heard what you said and I get that. And here's my response. And I'm sorry or whatever. Or I still think I was right. And, you know, it doesn't matter. But there's a company in Boulder who actually practices this process of withholds when they start meetings. They go around the table and anybody who has anything that they need to get cleared up before they can move forward in the process of that meeting to decide that thing gets to state their case. Nobody responds to it. Nobody answers. You just get a thank you. But it gets things out in front of the group so that there aren't these kind of underlying negative things that will submarine momentum. And I'm not recommending it, but I think it's interesting.
Yeah, one of the ironies about being an entrepreneur and starting a business is that most of us, you know, looked at the corporate world or the job world or, you know, kind of the manual labor world that we were in, and we said, this sucks. Mm-hmm. I could do better than this. And so we go start a business because we want to be free. We don't want to be controlled. We don't want to be treated like a robot. And then we get the business going, and we realize, oh, I need to hire some people. So we hire some people, and then we expect them to behave like robots, right, instead of remembering that they're actually human beings with feelings and ideas, and they like to be involved, which is, I think that one is ironic, right? And just saying to a team of people, which most entrepreneurs are very afraid of, just saying, okay, here's the direction that, you know, we're looking at going in. Here are the ideas that folks have suggested, or, you know, here's the plan that I've put together for us. Let's punch holes in this thing. What's wrong? What gives you a weird feeling in your stomach? And just letting everyone punch holes and vent and share their fears for 20 or 30 minutes is an amazing experience because, you know, in the middle of it, it feels like this thing could never work. Everyone hates it. No one likes it. No one's going to get behind it. All your worst fears have come true because you're thinking, oh no, you know, they're going to shoot this thing down. But then when it finally wraps up and everyone has shared all of their fears and so forth, then you talk to them, you sum them up, have a little discussion about it. At the end of 30 or 60 minutes of doing this, everyone takes a deep breath. Usually the idea was a good one, of course, But now everyone feels like they were heard and like they got to talk out their ideas. And as a friend of mine had someone running his business, he had a great quote. He said, if they help plan the fight, they won't fight the plan.
Exactly.
Just getting people, you know, to put in what they really think, even if it's negative, can just save so much hassle down the road.
Well, one of the things that I found is that certainly when you're in a position of leadership, you don't tend to be the shy one. And to have a good organization, there have to be lots of personality types, including people that are more introverted, more analytical, less the visionary person. And a lot of times I think, and this is especially true with women, that people in an organization might feel embarrassed to speak up in a meeting. They might feel marginalized. They might feel, if they're younger, like a middle manager, that they don't have as much to offer as a VP level person or something like that. And so your idea of allowing everyone to get in and beat up an idea is good. And what I would say is, a lot of times we'll hear somebody in charge set a strategy and we'll think to ourselves, boy, I don't like that. That's not going to work. But we don't have a better idea. And so we just stay silent. Instead of saying, you know, I don't have a complete solution to an alternative to that. But there are some things that give me pause that I wonder if we should talk about. And maybe we could come up with just fixing those pieces of this idea and make it a better idea. You know, a lot of times being able to do that, I think, is really good because so many people come from so many different perspectives on the possibilities, but they don't speak up because they don't feel like they have the whole answer.
Hmm. So do you have any insights that you'd like to share on hiring or managing great talent from your experience, things you may know how to do particularly well?
I'd say as far as hiring, I just work with one recruiter who knows the style of people that I like, and I train her or him really well and have them do a lot of the scouring with my own personal database and pulling in people that way. So a lot of pre-qualification before they get to me. And it's funny, I just lost my recruiter that I've worked with for the last half dozen or so years, and she just passed away, and I'm so sorry to lose her, because when you find your perfect match of a recruiter and you find someone that you can work with really well that gets the kind of people that you like, that you've been in the saddle with them for a long time, you should stay with that person. Outsourced recruiting, there are so many great independent recruiters, and creating a long-term relationship with one really pays off. And then the second thing I would say about that, once you have talent, so this is a goofy thing, but my special purpose, my life thing that I do really well, is that I see in the other person, I can look at a person and say, if I know them reasonably well, or even sometimes just a bit, I can show them things about themselves that they didn't realize were that valuable, that I know are super unique and really special about them. So what I try to do with my team is I try to think about how there's this curve of stuff they're really good at that they love to do all day and stuff they absolutely can't do. And an example of that is that when I run a sales team, I like to have, if I have the luxury of having multiple people on a team and not just one salesperson, depending on how big the company is, I really like to have a group of people who work together and they decide who's going to do what part of the sales process. So instead of it being, you know, these people only do customer support and these people only do cold calls and these people only do account management and whatever it might be, what I find is if you let a group of people own a piece of business, it might be a vertical, it might be a channel, it might be a geographic cut, you know, however you slice and dice your business. If you let that group dissect all of the things that have to be done and divvy them up amongst themselves so that they're leveraging their best talents within their team. And then if there's something that none of them like to do, like expense reports, right? Nobody likes to do those. Not a person in the world in sales or in any of those organizations that's going to say, oh, yeah, I'll just do all the sales reports. But what you do is you have them take turns. So one person goes in the office that day and does you know, 3 weeks worth of reports for everybody. And they take turns and rotate it around so that each person has their time in hell that they have to do. And everyone else is totally grateful that they have to do it a third less often or a quarter less often or whatever it might be. And so I like that strategy of letting a group of people figure out who owns what, if you can do it. And I feel good that I interviewed Marcus Buckingham. He wrote The Truth About You. He was the progenitor of the StrengthsFinder work at Gallup. And he said that's what he tells people when he consults with them. Find out what the talent pool is, who has what and does what best, and then mix and match that stuff all across your organization if you have to. And I thought, oh, that's great, because it worked for me too. And so I think more and more people are thinking about it less siloed and more collaboratively.
That's excellent. One of the things I know you love to do, think about, talk about, is creating products and kind of matching them to the markets that need them. Do you have some insights for us on how we can, you know, just do better at creating products that people want to buy?
It's so funny that you asked that. I feel horrible about it today. I'm struggling. I'm trying to build out a bunch of front-end products for our weight loss category. We have 5 different really nice niche weight loss products in our information product publishing side of our business.
Yep.
And I feel like everything we're coming up with is generic platitudes. Like, I just look at everything we have brainstorming and all the stuff we're working on, and I think, this is crap. What are we doing? What are we missing here? But the thing that I do find is that if you want to get an insight, talk to the person who spends all their time with that group of people, and they'll tell you, hey, you know what? This group of women who look for this kind of product, they're actually lonely and they want companionship. Now, who would have ever thought to put companionship and weight loss, with the exception of maybe Weight Watchers, you know, with their group things and stuff like that. And I think they probably have figured that out. Working with the people who are really involved in it at a psychological level and interviewing them deeply, asking 50 or 100 questions all about that group of people, that niche, that segment. That's what I've found to deliver the most insight that's actionable, that helps you solve the real problems happening with a group of people.
Excellent. Okay, so you're a chair emeritus of the Ad Tech Conference. You've started a couple of industry organizations. It's obvious that you're very interested in leadership. You sit on the boards of companies. What can a new entrepreneur, founder, someone that's growing a business, you know, what can they learn from you about how to lead their organization and about leadership in general?
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's like, why do I like it and what do I do, huh?
Well, tell me why you like it, too.
Yeah. Why I like it. Why do I like it? There's this thing in me where I can walk into a room and I can tell a lot of times, you know, how people are feeling, what the energy level is, are they satisfied, dissatisfied, and I can sense problems that people are having. I can see that they're frustrated or that they don't like the rules or the laws or the strategy or the whatever it might be. And what I like to do is stand up for the people. I don't know why, but I'm always the person who says, hey, we don't like this. You know, and there's a group of people behind me going, oh, thank God somebody said it, because I didn't think anybody was going to say it. That thing about looking down at a situation from 50,000 feet and getting an assessment of it and being willing to speak it, good, bad, or ugly. I don't know why I like to do that, but I do. It makes me feel good to be the mouthpiece for a group of people who might not be willing to say what they're thinking, but I know what they're thinking. I don't know why that is. I also like teamwork. You know, you've heard me speak about that a lot now, like the leader making sure that their direct reports work as a team, my sales team figuring out what they like to do and doing the things they like the best and dividing and conquering and working collaboratively. There's something for me that's very fulfilling about getting a group of people together to accomplish something. And the thing that's fulfilling about it for some reason for me is when I see people finding joy in accomplishment of the work they do together. And if I can be the catalyst for making that happen, it brings me pure joy. And I don't know why.
What is leadership?
I think leadership is, and I'll speak about it from the perspective of business. I think leadership is, number one, it's setting the strategy of the organization, actually being smart enough to figure out where you should go, what you should do, what is your offering, what does it consist of, and how do you create something that people want to buy. In the grand scheme of things, though there are others who support you, you don't do this in a vacuum. You are the ultimate determiner. You make the decisions based on all the given information and all the input. It's your job to take the stand and say, here's what we're building, this is what it's going to cost, and until I say otherwise or you convince me otherwise, this is what we're doing. So I think that's really number one. Number two is, of course, making it a pleasure to do that, right? So leadership by domination is not the way to success. And so it's a combination of both taking a stand and leaving plenty of open space around that stand for you to move your position based on input. The other thing that I think is really good, and one of the things that I love about working with my husband. So Tim and I have Personal Life Media together. We've had 8 startups between us. We've been on the boards of many companies. I've started 2 industry associations. We've started a lot of things. We've worked with a lot of people. We've been blessed with fabulous venture capital. We've bootstrapped things. We've done it all across the board. But the thing that I like the best is, in working with Tim, I can move on a dime. We can move on a dime. Given new information, we can change our course. And the good news is that everybody that works with us and for us trusts us enough that they sometimes they get frustrated. Sometimes they're like, I gave you what you asked for, and now you're telling me you want something else? You know, that happened to me yesterday, and I felt bad about it. But I got new information. So I think one of the things about being a leader is really being not only open to moving on a dime with the way the markets go, because markets are made and they die in a heartbeat, but it's also being able to communicate that in a way that doesn't rock the world of the people who you lead. And you, the older you get, the more you have to remember that when you're 20 and you have a job, you're in your 20s and you have a job and you work for somebody, when you make those changes, it rocks their world. They're not used to that yet. They've got to get used to how organizations shuck and jive with market dynamics. And so being both willing to change, follow the market, use your best information, and then communicating the safety of that somehow to your organization, that's the two sides of the coin that I think make a successful leader.
Ooh, that's very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, that, you know, I don't think I've ever heard someone say that before, or even anything like it.
Nice. Should I turn it into an ebook?
You probably should. Ralph, who's, you know, a friend and advisor and kind of a business mentor, who's worked with me for several years now, he pointed out to me that anytime you show up in the organization and you talk about change, that everyone in the organization says this is bad, and until proven otherwise. And the idea of really helping everyone to see how all the moves that you're making and all the changes you're making are for their benefit, what a great little insight about leadership.
Well, I have this little phrase that I learned through studying NLP that was an epiphany for me. And I'm not going to quote it correctly, and I think there's 23 versions of it anyway, but the essence of it is that behavioral flexibility, whoever has the most behavioral flexibility is going to be the winner. And it's so true. Either managing your own states, managing your own emotions, managing the forces of the market and moving to adjust to them, whatever it might be, your personal behavioral flexibility is the thing that will make you the winner. And if you can teach that to your employees, if you can teach that to your children, you know, that makes winners.
You talked about raising money and bootstrapping. You just kind of touched on it as you were sharing other points. You know, what's the difference? Which one do you recommend? What have you learned from each scenario?
I like them both. I'm not as good on the money side, so I've never been the one to raise the money. I've been on teams who've gone down Sand Hill Road pitching VCs, and luckily I have a lot of friends who are VCs, and they've been very kind to me, which is great. I can always get those meetings, and they'll tell me what, you know, what I need to do to make it a moneymaker and things like that. I like venture capital because then you have enough. You have enough capital, you have enough reserves, you have enough resources to really accomplish some great things. So it's nice when you have some money to hire the right people and do things the right way and put in the systems and infrastructure early to grow a business really nice and big. Beautiful. Love that. I also love bootstrapping because the thing that I learned when I took when I started at At Home Network and we were just a handful of people, like literally I walked in, they're like, here's your laptop, here's where you'll sit, and could you please just go invent broadband advertising? And I said, okay, cool. Oh, a PC? Can I get a Mac? Like that was my answer. It wasn't like, okay, I could totally invent broadband advertising, but can I have a Mac? I didn't get a Mac. It was really hard. Like I think it put me a couple months behind having to do it with a PC. But when we started and we were just a small group of people, we started with some good money. And then we grew and we grew and we were big and we were thousands of people. And then we started acquiring things. We acquired Blue Mountain Arts for $750 million, an e-card service. I mean, we made some stupid moves. I wasn't part of that one. But I had to integrate them, right? I had to take all that junk that all the guys were buying and make it all work together and turn it into something that were products that people could buy. And in all of that, we hit the dot bomb. And our market fell apart, and I had to lay off those 200 people. And I thought to myself, should I just get out of here and, like, let it all go down? And I just couldn't do it. I knew that what I was going to be doing was a little tiny bloodletting month after month after month where no one knew who was going to get it next because we had to shrink it down over time. It wasn't like I could let 200 people go. We were trying to preserve our cash and keep as many people as we could and try to pull out of it. And, you know, you call it death by paper cuts. I love that phrase, you know, where you're bleeding out just by slicing off these little pieces of yourself and letting go of people. And I had that to look forward to. I would fly around to our 7 locations and let the entire team go and close the door and mail the key to the landlord. You know, it was a brutal time. People hated me. And, you know, those big grown men would cry when I would lay them off. You know, it was just terrible. But I made the decision in that moment to be the person who, that was my team, and they had to go. And by the way, at the end, my VP of account management laid me off, and I laid her off, and then we laughed, and we went and had a glass of Chardonnay, you know? You're fired. Well, you're fired back. Let's go drink. But it was good. Going down, going all the way up, and then going all the way down that I realized that you can actually run a really big business. You can run a $100 million book of business with about 15 people if you're super organized and smart. And so it was preserving the cash, preserving the deals while still letting all the people go. And going through that, I realized I can do it on a shoestring. I don't need a lot of money. You just, especially today with great employees all over the world. I mean, we have employees in all different countries now who work with us 24/7. No longer are we, you know, we're virtual. It's all changed now with collaborative online services and international employees. You just can do so much more than you could ever do before. So would I in the future choose VC or self-funded? I'd go self-funded all the way. Having enough, a little tiny bit of capital to do that and a bootstrap, I always would pick bootstrap because managing VCs or anybody who loans you money, angels, your mother, whatever, huge pain in the butt. So much nicer to have the autonomy, which is a part of why you're entrepreneurial anyway. So unless you have this gargantuan idea that's going to take tons of capital, you know, you're laying plumbing or whatever you're doing, best to bootstrap if you can. That's just my advice.
Hmm. Yeah. Also, we live in a new time. In the past, if you were starting a business, it often required you to like go lease, you know, some retail space or get a bunch of cars or, you know, who knows what.
All the tangibles, yeah.
Exactly, all these offices, and you need like $100,000 just to open up the door. Whereas now, you can take your idea, you can use some various channels online, go on, test the thing out, and just see if the basic idea works. You know, just see if people are interested in it. And you can really use a kind of a whole different way. It's like it evolves organically.
I do think there's going to be a backlash from this. You want to hear it?
Hit me.
Okay. So I was moderating a Girls in Tech panel couple days ago, the Catalyst Conference, and we were talking about building brands in niche markets. And I had the CEOs of Communicate.io, Blurb, the online book company, and Eventbrite on my session. And it was very interesting that all three of them in the preparation for the panel were telling, I heard something. I heard a thread. And the thread that I heard was, our offline marketing activities generate more for us than all of the online stuff that we do. It's the stuff that actually propels our business forward. And what they were saying was, it's great to do PR and hit up the mommy bloggers to do blog posts and have a community and run online advertising and, you know, all that stuff you do on the internet to drive your brand. But that it was in reality when they would get together with their customers that they would see the word of mouth and the enthusiasm for their brand and get ideas for making their products better, and that was the part, the, you know, the wetware, the people, the offline, the real world, that, remember that, the IRL, in real life thing. we can't lose touch with that. And the thing that I'm worried about with all this globalization is, I'd like to see Patty Padmanahan, my lead programmer from Chennai, face-to-face sometime soon. You know, our whole organization is families that work for our family in Florida, in Washington, in India, all over the world. And we don't get together enough, if ever. And that is the problem with the virtual marketing, the virtual world, the internet. We got to get out of our chairs and into the wetware.
So let's maybe change pace a little bit here. You also mentioned this term earlier, co-opetition.
Yeah.
Which I'm fascinated with, right?
Oh, I have a funny story about that.
Yeah. What is it, and how do you do it, and why do you do it?
Okay. So here's a story of me. Literally, I was sweating bullets in this meeting. I was, like, the back of my shirt was totally soaked. I just was dripping with sweat. My hair was wet. I was so stressed out. This is my co-opetition story. I started a podcasting business 3 years ago. I wanted to build out this podcasting network. So we have 40 shows on our network now, and they're doing really well. And we've got a nice distribution channel for our information products. And I said, what the hell is wrong with this industry? They're not talking to each other. I came out of the internet advertising world where we started the IAB in 1996. We all got together and said, we need an industry association for publishers, and we're all trying to grow our business. So let's band together. Let's do market research. Let's, you know, let's work together. We're all competing for the same dollars, but we can grow those dollars if we all work together. So we started the Internet Advertising Bureau, the IAB. I just lifted that model for the podcasting industry, and I started the Association for Downloadable Media. So I had the idea, we need this podcaster association. So I called up all the people in the business, and I was brand new to the business. I didn't know anybody. I had just been doing my show, my Dishy Mix show. I'm now 6 years into it. I've been doing it every week for years. And that's what started me on this whole thing of doing a podcast network. I loved my podcast. And I called up all these people, and I said, hey, we should start this. I have this idea to start this industry association, and we're going to have a meeting. I used the offices of Kara, one of my sponsors, let me use their office in San Francisco. I got people to fly in from DC, New York, LA. Everybody came in. They were all competitors. There were 15 of them in the room. And I start talking to them about my vision. You know, we have to work together. We're all competitors, but if we're going to make this a real market, we have to work together. I talked for 45 minutes. They peppered me with questions. They were sitting back in their chairs, sneering at me with their shoulder cocked, with a, you know, kind of an eagle eye looking at me like, who is she? And what is she trying to pull over on us? Like, no trust at all. They didn't know me from Adam. About 45 minutes, an hour into it, an hour and 15. This is the time and I'm just sweating. All of a sudden, they got it. You could just see that. The air lifted, like the sun shined in the room, and everybody was like, oh, she's actually not trying to get over on us. She's trying to get us to all work together. We could make our businesses better if we work together. You know, it was like, bing, the epiphany. And they all, in that moment, decided to band together and form the Association for Downloadable Media. We've done industry standards. We've done all kinds of, you know, research projects and brought people together who would have never talked to each other about the problems in the industry and all those kinds of things. And it was in that moment that I said to myself, okay, you can do this. You can do this in any market. You can do this in any model. And it's exactly what you say, Eben, with your masterminds. If you want to go dominate a category, go pull all the people together in that category. It's brilliant. It's all the same thing. It's co-opetition.
Hmm. Yeah, it really is. It blows my mind, Susan. I actually was thinking this morning about what we've learned from systems thinking and systems dynamics, and just how most individual people, they try to just get for themselves rather than making the whole or the system they're in work better, which will make things much better for them, and how individual businesses really see themselves as alone and in competition with others. And I've talked to very savvy business people and said, hey, you should go meet this person over here because they kind of do something similar to you and you could share resources or you're looking for the same kind of people. And they go, oh, I see them as competitive. Like, that's a good logical reason to not make friends with another amazing human being.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just so limiting.
Well, I think that the information product world is a really rare and beautiful industry because it combines so much of what's created solves problems for people. And people are so smart and analytical that I love that. And they have this real belief that if I can put wind in your sails, it'll just make us all move forward faster. And you see it time and time again. I love this industry. I haven't loved an industry since I met all the search engine optimization people. And I loved how they were like geeky, quant, renegade, crazy people. And I thought, I like these people. These people are cool. I like these search engine people. And now I've gotten into the information product world and I'm like, oh my God, they're even better to me because they have that combination that I just described.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's zoom out yet another level here. You also advise and have advised a lot of businesses. Most people don't know what it's like to sit on a board or be an advisor or how you do that or what happens in those meetings. Can you open up the boardroom for us and explain to us, number one, how do you advise a business? What do they need? And second, what happens in those meetings? And then I guess finally, how should someone choose a board? How should they consider creating one for themselves?
Sure, you can always have your personal board of directors, absolutely. Well, I'm on the board of directors and I'm on the board of advisors of different companies. And so when you're on the board of directors, you have more fiscal responsibilities. A lot of the conversations are around things like, employee stock options and hiring and firing policies and things like that. And you're also often working at a level of just, should we move into China? That level of things. When you're on the board of advisors, a lot of times you're being tapped for a little bit more of your vertical expertise. And since my vertical expertise is sales and marketing, market positioning, and go-to-market strategies, launching products into the technology and consumer web services world, how you position yourself against your competition, launch strategies, all of those kinds of things. In the more traditional, not the information product JV launch kind of world, it's different. And so a lot of times what I'll be brought in for is I'll be brought into board meetings where we go through the strategy of the company and everything that's been happening with them and what's in their pipeline and what deals they've won and what deals they've lost. And we'll talk about all those things. And then a group of us will give our feedback in our different various areas of expertise. And then sometimes I'm just brought in because I'm on the advisory board by a couple of employees who, with the CEO, say, can you come in and talk to us about this crazy idea we have to get into this new market? And, we'll just talk about one thing that they want to talk about. So it really runs the gamut. But the thing that I didn't understand or that I was surprised about by being on a board is that a lot of times the CEO needs an external sounding board. And often it's about ethical things that come up where customers are asking them to do something they're not comfortable with, or they know their customers are taking advantage of them, or their employees are taking advantage of them. And for an entrepreneur, they might feel like they should be giving and giving and giving, and they need someone external to run some of those more ethical or questionable or problematic situations by a reasonably objective third party who has the best interest of the organization and that CEO.
Excellent. Awesome. Okay, Susan. So, we've talked about all these different topics, but the thing that we haven't talked about yet is the thing that I always hear when I hear your name come up, which is she's connected to everyone. Right? She's the best networker in Silicon Valley and blah, blah, blah. You know, what is networking? How does it work? And why are you great at it? And how do we do it?
Networking is connecting with a person to understand what their value is, not only to you, but to the world, so that instead of it just being a selfish thought about how you might be able to get something from them, you're thinking about how you can help them or how they might be able to help somebody else, and that would better both of them moving forward. How I network is I really like people, so it's easy for me. It's so genuine. I don't walk into a room and think to myself, how many people can I get business cards from, or whatever people think networkers do, or, you know, how many people can I get something out of? I walk into the room and go, how many of these totally cool people can I meet, and what will delight me about them? And I actually started about 2 years ago, I started doing this little thing, this little trick, and that is, if I walk into a conference or I walk into a room of people at an event of some kind, I'll stop and I'll look around the room and I'll take as long a time as I want to do this. And I will just look at all the people in the room. I'll notice if I know some people in the room. I'll notice who's most interesting to me. Like what? Who's attracting me here? Who looks interesting to me, or has a presence about them, or what group is clustered together that looks like they're having a really interesting conversation? And that's where I'll head. And what I'll do is, for the most part, I'll just go from my first favorite person to my second favorite person to my third favorite person. And I'll stop for a minute and I'll just look around when I'm done with a conversation. And I will always give them my card, even if they don't have one. And if I give someone my card and they don't just get one right out, I say, oh, I'd like to have your card too. I want to make sure I remember that we met. Because people are pretty bad about getting their cards out. And if they don't have one, I say, well, you know what? You don't have one? No worries. I hope you'll send me an email so that we can connect in the future if there's ever an opportunity. Because I can't control that, but I'd like to make sure that I remember that I met them. Because they'll potentially show up again. So I do like that. People always say too, well, how do you break away? Like, what's the way you can work the room? Because I don't know how to leave somebody. And I always just say, hey, there are a couple other people I absolutely need to go say hi to. I have really enjoyed connecting with you. I hope I'll see you again, maybe later during the conference or during the event or whatever, but I got a cruise. And they'll say, okay, cool. Great to meet you. Being just really straightforward about what you're doing there, nobody minds that you leave them. Or sometimes I do the connect to other people and then walk away. Sometimes I say, I'll be back. I'm going to get a drink. I hope I'll connect with you again. Just simple stuff. It doesn't need to be laborious. So I try to go around the room and just see who's there and what they're doing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's a lot of fun. And I'll come back from an event. Like I just went to Affiliate Summit and I probably came back with, I don't know, 50 cards. And there are 8 people that I met in those 3 days at that event that are probably going to have an impact on my business going forward. And they're the ones that I'll actually send a follow-up email to, or I'll call them and leave them a quick message, or call them and say, hey, don't want to talk long, just wanted to let you know that I really appreciated you doing whatever that was, that thing, or I really liked meeting you and I think there might be some opportunity to work together. So I just wanted to say that, and you're probably busy, but we can talk whenever, it's good. Doing those kind of things, the personal phone call is really important. And then I have my assistant put them into my Batch Blue address book. And then I have my assistant, I pick the group that I want, and I have my assistant link with them on LinkedIn and connect with them on Facebook if they're, you know, if I want to, because I can't do all those things myself, but I like to keep my connections with people. So that's kind of my process for working a room and networking and how I do it.
Yeah, when you go to a kind of a social event or a function where people are hanging out, I think most of us forget that most of the people there don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to start a conversation. And when there's someone walking around who's saying, who are you and what are you good at? Oh, come over here. Here's somebody else like you. Mm-hmm. That's like the highest value thing you can do in that environment. And yet, of course, you know, most of us are kind of going, oh, what should I say? rather than just diving in and adding lots of value.
Well, a lot of times the most interesting people will be huddled in a corner all talking to each other and feeling kind of you'd feel excluded. What I do is I just go right there and I squeeze my way in and I go, hey, what are you guys talking about? It looks really interesting. And they say, whatever they're talking about, and then I'm part of it. It's so easy to enter groups. People are happy to have you if you show interest in them.
That's great. Thank you for the pointers.
Sure.
Susan, it has been spectacular talking to you. Thanks for sharing all the wisdom.
I hope it was helpful.
If someone wanted to check out your companies, your websites, learn more about you, how would they do that?
Google me.
Do you want to do a little pitch?
All I have to do is Google Susan Bratton. You'll find Personal Life Media, my Dishy Mix show, all of our products. It's easy. It's Google.
Love it. Thank you very much, Susan.
Evan, thank you so much.